so Susan has play practice, so it's just going to be me.
Cool.
I'm Caroline.
All right, Caroline, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So I know you as Chaz of the Dead, but do you want to, like, tell our listeners a little bit about you and what you do?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a paranormal investigator. I write for Paranormality Magazine and FringeFM.com. I also have my own book out. It's called Paranormal Expeditions, Hunt for the Friendship. It's about an investigation I did in South America involving UFOs, Nazis, and psychedelics. So if you like weird stuff, check it out.
Sounds amazing.
Hopefully everything goes well. There'll be a couple more of those paranormal expeditions in the future. But that one was, I went to Chile to look into this case of this group called the Friendship. And they claim themselves to be extraterrestrials to the people they've interacted with. But they're also tall, blonde humanoids. You know, the Pleiadian archetype, if you will.
Yeah.
And so, of course, South America has a long history of some other tall, blonde invaders, let's say, who were there. So I went down and I looked into the UFO lore and kind of this, you know, Nazi explanation as well, this kind of human explanation, and conducted some weird experiments with some psychedelics and things like that along the way. So it was definitely a interesting trip.
Definitely. I actually just came across this place in Mexico today called the Zone of Silence. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, I actually lived in Mexico for 3 years. And I always wanted to get out to the Zone of Silence, but it's in an area of Mexico that, well, while I was living there, let me just say, you couldn't go there without hiring some hefty security.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, this is a weird place, the Zone of Silence. There was a U.S. missile, some kind of experimental missile that supposedly flew off course and landed in this zone. Compasses and radar, if you're flying, and those things seem to deactivate when flying over this zone. And of course, there's lots of weird explanations from, you know, some scientific explanations from, oh, it's minerals in the ground, to, oh, it's other people claiming UFO bases, you know, it's connects all the way up to Roswell and to Area 51, and it's a massive underground complex, which is fun, but it's, you know, it's hard to say, though there are a lot of weird stories that come out of that area in particular.
Yeah, I brought it up because I saw on a YouTube video I was watching about it, a lot of people claim to see three tall, blonde, humanoid creatures, like, in the middle of Mexico, and so many people have claimed to see them, and they can't figure out if they're, like, real and they're really there, or if it's just, like, an urban legend, but that kind of reminded me of it.
Right, yeah, it's that same archetype, the Friendship, though they're just being a little further south in Patagonia, at the very edge of South America there, towards Antarctica. And yeah, there's these tall blonde people, and they seem to appear to these local, sparsely populated coastal towns and make weird bargains with the people who live there, you know, trading them in, like, gold coins and platinum chunks to, you know, smuggle them secret technical supplies and things like that. So it's definitely this weird group. And going to Chile and talking to people, I definitely think there was someone claiming to be the Friendship. I'm not going to say they were aliens, and I'm not going to say they were Nazis either, because that explanation still has its own holes as well. But it's definitely something was happening in the late 80s and early 90s, and still to this day people can claim to have these interactions with the group. And it's something you have to consider. What kind of got me started in the paranormal, I think, like many people, was a experience. When I was younger, I was moved into my older brother's room, and they built these bunk beds on top of the bed that was there. He moved up to the top bunk, and I moved to the bottom one. And one night, I fell out of bed, and there was this pair of red eyes staring back at me. And it was almost like a Halloween graphic, you know, like the ones you put on a window or on a pumpkin. And, you know, being a kid, I hopped back in bed and put the blanket over my head and, you know, waited till the morning. Next morning, I got out of bed and I started cleaning underneath my bed, you know, in the security of daylight to see if there was anything electric that could have made those lights or, you know, any source for, mm-hmm. for what I witnessed. And my brother, he was coming down the ladder, saw what I was doing, and without me prompting or saying anything, he said, "Did you see the lights too?" Because he had seen them a few weeks beforehand, and he had been absolutely terrified by them. And
were they underneath the bed?
Yeah, underneath the bed in the exact same kind of situation. And no, it definitely was kind of this aha moment where even now looking back at it, you know, our house wasn't really haunted or anything. It wasn't like one out of a million. No, it's just this kind of one off. But even in its simplest explanation, it's a shared dream. Well, mm-hmm. that in itself is something paranormal. You know, people shouldn't be able to share dreams in our current understanding. So yeah. It was kind of this moment that confirmed for me, you know, weird stuff happens.
That's wild. So do you think it was, what do you think it was? Or do you just don't know?
I'm not sure. I think it might have just been a shared dream. You know, As I've grown older, dreams are weird. Definitely people dream about similar symbology and those kinds of things. But, you know, knowing that there's a way for our brains to share these images without communicating, because we'd never talked about it before. That was, you know, that's still the kicker. And that's still, I think, where I investigate the phenomenon, how I investigate it still reflects that, because it is definitely something that is involved with our consciousness. It interacts with us in a way that's similar to how our mind interacts with reality. And it's somewhere in between that gray zone where this phenomenon lies. So that's why I try to look at that kind of perspective.
Dreams have always fascinated me. I remember when I was little, I got a dream book. It kind of explained what each type of dream meant. And it still fascinates me today. Lately, my husband says I've started to pop up in the middle of the night and like talk to him. And I have no recollection of it. And he says I say weird shit like there's nobody at the end of the line and like just really creepy shit. And I'm trying to figure out where that's coming from or if it's I'm smoking too much pot before I go to bed. I don't know what's going on.
That can do it. It's probably doing these shows all the time. Yeah. It's a miracle I don't have more nightmares and stuff. I mostly get stress dreams. Last night I had the one where I was, you know, at school without my underpants on, kind of like classic, you know, archetype there. But, you know, not too many scary things. Though every once in a while, I definitely think it bleeds through a late night of research and then you go to bed and you wake up, oh,
you know. Creepiest experience you've ever had, if there is one.
I think the creepiest, the most on edge investigating I've ever been was actually when working on my book. And I went to this place called Villa Bavaria. And this was formerly Colonia Dignia Dot. It was kind of it's the super remote compound, and it was run by these ex-Nazis. And that was why it was the scariest place I've been. Not because I've any ghosts or aliens or anything. It was hard to get to. I had to take a bus to a village and then pay some guy, just walked up to his door and knocked because someone gave me instructions. This is the guy who'll take you there.
This is like out of a movie.
Yeah, it was weird. And I paid him, you know, like 10 bucks. And he drove me even further into the mountains. And you first hit this fence in this massive abandoned guard tower. And then it goes further and further and further. And then you finally get to this area and there's a guard gate. And once you get past that, there's this little hotel and like a German themed restaurant. And they've got like a big circus tent set up. And it's this kind of like super isolated German speaking community in the middle of Chile. And it was set up by a man named Paul Schaefer, who he was a medic in World War II with the Nazis. And he set up this kind of religious cult in this compound. And he was eventually arrested for child molestation. He was preying on the children in his compound. But while he was active, he was a known element within the government. And the government, when they wanted someone to disappear, they'd say, send them to the Germans. And these people would go to this compound and they'd never be seen again. And to this day, most of these graves haven't been found. And it's in this massive, massive remote compound. And it was weird. It was definitely the closest, I think, doing my investigations I've come to like real journalism, you know,
did
where
they accept
you're like,
you?
Well, I didn't mention that I was there to write about Nazi UFOs. I left that out. I kind of was just like, oh, we heard about this. It was a nice place to spend a weekend. And kind of played it off that way. Did have some really good German food in the restaurant. The staff was really nice and everything. Though the first night I was there, I kind of snuck out in the middle of the night and snooped around because I wanted to see it without the guide. That was definitely a little weird, a little nerve-wracking, walking around the kind of empty museum. They just turned this big barn into a museum about the history of the compound. It's definitely a strange location. And they still seem to maintain some ties to the government. There's people have their weddings out there, surprisingly. the former Nazi compound, let's go get married. It's a weird place. But most of the people I noticed in the photo albums that were getting married there were military officers. So it seems like there's still this kind of connection, far right kind of ideology connecting them to the government still. And they did find a weapons cache on the property a couple years ago. Now, they said that was from a long time ago. They had no idea it was there, but, you know, who knows for sure. So that was one of the creepiest locations, I think, from just a pure, how nervous, how like, schemed out I've ever been. A ghost hasn't quite made me that nervous yet.
You did all this alone, your whole trip and everything, or did you do it with somebody?
I was actually traveling with an ex-girlfriend of mine. She was from Mexico. We were living there together. So she definitely helped with a lot of the Spanish and translating and that kind of stuff. She was a big help with the book on a whole on the entire process. We're still good friends and stay in touch. Yeah, she helped with the psychedelic experiments and all that kind of stuff. So it was definitely good to have that help. Though I did not tell her about that place's history until we got there. I kind of like, because I knew she'd be like, oh, no way, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to go. So, yeah, we kind of just showed up and she's like, why is everything German themed in this place? And I was like, got this weird history, and she looks it up on her phone, and she's like, I can't believe you brought me here. This is horrible.
So do you have a theory about do you have an opinion on the theory about how Hitler escaped to Argentina?
So I think there's a lot of good evidence for it. Well, I guess the evidence for it is the lack of evidence for the official story.
Right.
And I think most people are, you know, who are into this kind of weird alternate history stuff, know that they, Hitler supposedly died in the bunker and the Russians collected some fragments of his skull. Well, those skull fragments were tested a few years back and they were found to be female. So they're pretty sure it wasn't Hitler. So again, this official story that he died in this bunker is kind of up in the air. Not really anything to confirm that. The other end of it is he escaped through the rat lines, the Vatican. There were a lot of people helping Nazi officers escape.
I have not heard the Vatican thing.
Oh yeah, so actually that connects to the friendship group, because all of the members of the friendship have these angelic names like Michael and Ariel and these, you know, right out of the Bible names. And there was this clear rat line from other people like Paul Schaefer, because he went over to Chile kind of under the guise of religion. He used it kind of as a cloak to set up his compound. So there were a lot of the officers who were, you know, quick converts to Catholicism and were scooted out of there under you know, cloak and shadow. But the Hitler theory, I actually put one forward in my book that he might have escaped on a U-boat. He actually left the after his death, after his suicide, when officially he was killed. The Nazis didn't admit it to being a suicide, but he died a few days before the bunker was supposedly blown up. And he left and left in charge Admiral Donuts. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. But I can never not remember it as Donuts. So Admiral Donuts was, he was in charge of the U-boats before he was the Grand Admiral. And he had all these, it was unrestricted submarine warfare was like his idea. And he had all these, you know, all the routes for all the U-boats and things. And of course, after World War II, in the next decade, U-boats start washing up on South American shores, you know, one every year or so, a couple in, you know, it drops off as the years go on. But that first year after the war, there was, you know, six or seven that washed up in Brazil alone. And so all these U-boats kind of wound up. And there's one famous account from Argentina where a U-boat landed and supposedly dropped off a bunch of people at night dressed in civilian garb who were picked up. And supposedly there was a man and a woman who resembled Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. That's how the story goes. And the next day that U-boat turned itself in to the harbor, and the rest of the crew were, you know, sent to a U.S. Prison camp. So again, you know, there's a lot of these stories, a lot of these claims. Even into the 1960s, there were sightings of U-boats in Argentine harbors. There was one famous event from, I think, 62. Some people say it was a sea monster, but the official Argentinian Navy's official stance was it was a submarine, and it looked like a German submarine. But of course, this is 20 years after, you know, the Nazis were done. So they said maybe it's, of course, they go pointing fingers and saying, hey, it's the U.S. or it's the Russians. Well, the U.S. sends like this package of depth charges, like this special naval equipment as like, hey, it's not us here. Good luck blowing this thing up. The Russians deny it as well in like a formal way. They don't send any bombs or anything, but they also make this denial. But it was one of the captains of these destroyer ships that was chasing down the submarine who said it looks like this German-made submarine, these ones that they just made at the end of the war. They weren't really even using them outside of training missions yet because they hadn't been perfected, but that's what it looks like. And again, there's another idea that that's what was happening, that Hitler was just in a submarine and he's been living in a submarine, you know, going crazy for however long now.
Wow.
Which, another fun theory, but I think even if he did escape, I think it's pretty safe to say he's dead now.
Yeah.
It would take some pretty crazy brain in the jar stuff to keep him alive, but... that's why these stories are fun, because, you know, no one puts it past the Nazis. Maybe they got his brain in a jar somewhere.
My husband and I watch, he loves World War II stuff. So we watch a lot of like Nazi stuff, and we watched one episode. I can't remember the show, but it was talking about how the Nazis, built a base in Antarctica, and they found like hollow earth. And I'm like, I don't know. How do we know they didn't? How do we know? We don't know.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I've actually been doing a bunch of Antarctic research recently.
Oh, awesome.
I have a good ghost story from there. But to first start with the Nazi stuff, because, yeah, that's there's the claim of Operation High Jump or Project High Jump, whichever it was.
I think it's Project, but I'm not sure.
You're right. This was a massive military operation at the South Pole. And they say, some say, it's the final battle of World War II where the Nazis brought out their UFOs and they actually beat us. And they still have a secret base in Antarctica. And that's why no one is allowed to go there, which is a great story.
Yeah.
But people are allowed to go there. So that kind of trumps that whole, like, you know, this is a thing, and flat earth people are really about it too. No one can go to Antarctica. Yeah, you can buy a ticket. Like, you can get a boat and they'll take you and they'll drop you off and you can walk around. Like, it's expensive.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely doable. So it's a fun idea. And it actually, that a huge source of that theory stems back to Admiral Dönitz, who during his Nuremberg trial, he said that they had discovered an earthly paradise that remains hidden from the rest of the world. And of course, a lot of people jump on this and say, oh, it's the Hollow Earth. And
yeah,
they got the secret base Antarctica.
Yeah.
In my book, I suggest perhaps it was just a secret base in Patagonia and that this friendship group were, they're occupying that hidden paradise.
Yeah.
Having been to Patagonia, it's definitely more of a paradise than Antarctica. It's cold. It's a little chilly there, but it's beautiful. It absolutely. And it's very similar to the northern coast of Germany, to the fjords in Norway. It has a very similar kind of topography to what a German admiral might consider a paradise. So it definitely is an interesting correlation there. And I think without a doubt, you can look at, you know, all over South America and find examples where they did, you know, kind of reband together in these locations. So the Antarctic theory is a fun one.
Yeah, it is.
I definitely like the idea that I talk about the Nazi Bell and the idea that they had UFO technology. And I've actually more recently been working on a thing called B theory, which is kind of this alternate explanation out there for how humans have created UFOs. And it was told to me by some crazy people. But first I wanted to touch on the ghost of Carl Ditch, which is this article I wrote for Paranormality Magazine, and it's about Antarctica and its kind of first urban legend. So Carl Ditch was a radio isonospheric scientist, and he was stationed at the Edmundson Scott base, which is the one right at the South Pole, very at the bottom. Reason they send people like him, it's a form of astronomy. So he's there because the sky is perfectly dark for 6 months straight. And, you know, it's a different view than the entire rest of the world. So it's a very kind of important station. And the story goes that the official story is that he walked off he was working at this radio tower. And he was meant to, you know, walk about a mile back to the rest of the station. And they had these lines hooked up. If anyone's ever seen The Thing, yeah, you know what I mean? With they hammer the poles in and they loop so they don't get lost in the blizzard.
Yeah.
And apparently he missed it. Something happened and he vanished. And the station searched for him. There was a blizzard at the time, so they couldn't continue the search. They had to go back, and then they tried again a few hours later, but he was never found, and his body has never been found. And this is the kind of the official story. And it got weirder when people supposedly started to get radio messages at different stations from Carl. And this was kind of like this weird, they'd get these weird Lovecraftian messages of like chaos and the world destroyed and I am Carl. And they were very, very strange. People who would return to the Edmundson Scott base supposedly would find Carl was here, scratched on doors and things like that.
Like on the outside of doors?
Yep, on the outside of doors. And if a lock was ever like found broken or something like that, they'd blame it on Carl. And these kind of, and this weird legend has kind of formed. Since I wrote that article, some people who worked at the station at the time have reached out to me and they've been like, that's all baloney. And, a couple of different people admitted to when they would have visitors, writers, newspaper reporters and stuff, they'd kind of like tell them the story of Carl as like a boogeyman, and they kind of perpetuated this this legend. But one of Carl's family members got upset about it, and they kind of stopped. So they kind of stopped the legend there. But still to this day, it pops up on like unsolved forums and unsolved mysteries, Reddit, and those kind of things, of these mysterious messages when it was, you know, actually just kind of this, you know, a way to relieve the stress, of being on the base. But the flip side of it is one of the people I have reached out to me has indeed informed me that the official story of him walking off from his workstation is not true. There was actually a disagreement during a poker game, and he walked out of the main base without his jacket. So this is a new piece of information that hasn't popped up anywhere else. And so that there's some intrigue there, and whether foul play or not is involved is something that I think is possibly going to be relooked at after some of these interviews. So that's Carl Ditch, Antarctica's first urban legend. And I think it's a one to remember and one to consider because it's a unfolding story.
What year did all that take place?
I believe he went missing in 71.
Okay.
If you want to, you can find the article. It's got all the exact information on fringefm.com or in the, I think it was like the May or June issue of Paranormality magazine.
Okay.
But it's, yeah, Antarctica's first urban legend, Fringe FM.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, so it's a weird story. And again, I'm having to do a part two now because I'm getting so many, you know, emails and letters about it. So it's definitely a weird one. These old Antarctic explorers, they're very, it's a weird community. They're still very active. They like have their own websites and forums and stuff. It's bizarre. And there's some interesting characters.
Were you going to say something else about Antarctica?
I think I was going to go on a different, totally different diatribe about B theory.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it is spelled B-E-E. It is bees, as in the insect. But it's a little pun because it is my secondary theory. I do think the paranormal phenomenon as a whole is there's something to do with our reality, something to do with our consciousness. There's this kind of grand puzzle. It involves biocentrism and all this stuff. But bee theory is a really fun story.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about that. It's my second theory, and it puts all of it on us human beings, our shoulders,
okay.
And say we're the source of it, at the very least, the UFO phenomenon. And the first person to expose me to bee theory was this crazy guy I met in Morocco about 5 years ago. I was traveling through the country, backpacking, hanging out, smoking hashish, you know, enjoying the sights and
living
sounds.
Life.
Yeah. But of course, I'd still write and, obsess over weird stories and kind of collect them as I go. So a buddy of mine said, oh, I know this guy you need to meet. He's a friend of a friend, and I met him once, and he's your cup of tea. You got to talk to this guy. So I met him in a roadside cafe, and he told me some of the craziest stories I've ever heard. He claimed to be the son of a CIA agent, and without getting too into it, there was some information that kind of backed it up. Nothing bulletproof, nothing solid, but some assets and things that I was like, okay, well, maybe he's legit for a weirdo. And he told me, the weirdest thing he told me was that he knew people who flew UFOs, and that UFOs were based on honeybees. That honeybees had an anti-gravity chamber in their thorax, and they could use, they reverse engineered this to create UFOs. And I was like, huh, that's crazy. Sure, whatever you say, cool. And I, you know, I never forgot that because it stood out. I didn't even have to write it down because I was like, that's the craziest thing I've heard in a long time. And I kind of kept it with me for several years. And I included it as this one kind of one-off paragraph in my book about the Nazi Bell. It was specifically about the concept of the Nazi Bell. And I said, oh, well, one time this crazy guy told me that it was based off of bees. So maybe the Nazis just discovered that, and that's how they did it. That was it. Yeah. And I just put this a paragraph, maybe 4 or 5 sentences. And I was doing a podcast last year talking about the book. And the host of that show said that paragraph jumped out at him because a friend of his, he had a friend whose father, they always understood to be a man in black. That's all he understood his job to be, that he would go and intimidate people, and it had something to do with UFOs. When this guy was on his deathbed, the son pressed him for more information, like, tell me something about the UFOs, like, tell me what's going on. And all he would say was, look at the bees. And for years, the son and the friend who was hosting this podcast, they thought it had something to do with how bees communicate. And there are a lot of mysterious things about bees. Mm-hmm. Until he read my book and he said, oh shit, that's that's probably what it had, you know, that's probably what he meant. And so now I had these two, again, shadowy, unconfirmed sources. They're really stretching it, right? Now I'm outside of journalism because it's a weird story. It's weird, two weird stories. But these guys are murky at best. So I was like, well, let's look into this. Is there anything true about this? And there was this long time kind of saying or myth or belief that bees were too heavy to fly. I think they even say that at the beginning of the Jerry Seinfeld bee movie. It says bees are too heavy to fly, but they don't care what humans think, so they do so anyways. Something like that. Nowadays, scientists believe they fly using this special whirlwind pattern, and that's how they do it. But there is a mystery still about bees, and it's this thing they call economy mode. Mm-hmm. And when the bees are carrying pollen, they seem to be lighter than they are normally. So if you say, for this example, you have a bee that weighs a gram, I don't know how much bees weigh, so I'm just example here, and it picks up another gram of pollen, it should weigh 2 grams and it should fly, you know, about this fast, and it should breathe about this much. Well, instead, it ends up weighing 0.9 grams with the full load of pollen. And scientists have no idea how they do it. Somehow they become way more efficient when they're lifting these heavy loads. So scientists might not know how, but from my crazy sources, I'm starting to think now, well, maybe they have this anti-gravity chamber. And so this is when I stumbled upon the research of a Russian entomologist, an insect scientist, mm-hmm. whose name was Viktor Gerbinikov. And he, towards the end of his life, wrote a memoir about his various discoveries in entomology. He discovered this thing called the cavity structure effect. Mm-hmm. It's this special kind of electromagnetic field that comes off of honeycomb-shaped patterns. And seems to be kind of tied into his UFO research. And his UFO research is that he wrote this one-off paragraph in this one-off chapter, I'm sorry, in this book about how he built a flying craft based on the exoskeletons of insects. And he said it was certain kinds of beetles and things. And he wouldn't get too specific in his research because the insects he was using, he believed to be, it wasn't endangered, but he didn't want it to become endangered.
Yeah.
Right? It was threatened. So he was worried if he plugged this out, people would go and kill all the bugs.
Yeah.
But he was saying, right, exactly. And the bees are dying. So perhaps, perhaps they are doing this. So he said he found this special pattern that would give off the CSE effect inside the exoskeletons of certain insects. And when you tested them under a microscope, they seemed to float in these weird, impossible ways. And so he strapped a bunch of them together into these blocks that seemed to defy gravity. He would like touch it with a pencil and it'd fly up to the ceiling. And there's some weird videos and pictures and stuff. And again, they're super grainy. They're from the 90s and early 2000s from Siberia in Russia.
Yeah.
So again, it's not the best visual evidence, but his claims are fascinating. He said that he strapped a bunch of these blocks together into this kind of little moped, like wood. It just looks like a wooden platform with some handlebars. It looks kind of like a Segway, but a wooden block at the bottom. And he supposedly this would float and fly at tremendous speeds. And on his first test flight, he took it around the town, this little university town he worked at, for like a test drive. And the next day in the newspaper, there was this mass sighting of a UFO over the city, these three yellow dots in a triangle shape, but it followed his exact flight pattern. And as he continued to test it, he would note that people on the ground looking up at him, they would never see a little bug scientist on his flying platform. They would see these glowing discs or these giant triangles and these classical UFO shapes. What he also noted is that UFOs like these were being seen across Europe at the same nights he was doing his tests. So he was like, well, that wasn't me. So someone else has discovered this UFO secret and they're not telling people about it. So he decided not to tell anyone about it. He decided, I'm going to just put this down and go back to insect science. Another reason he put it down was because of all the strange side effects that would occur when he would fly his little craft. He would take it out to these remote fields in Siberia where he was doing insect research. And he would land, when he would land there and collect specimens, he'd put them in the little jars and they'd be larvae. And some of them, when he flew back, they'd be fully grown. Something that would take weeks, but he was only on the craft for 2 hours. Other times when he would drop vials over buildings and things like that, they would appear miles away, wedged into, like fused into somebody's window and things like this. There would be like little perfect circles missing from his glass vials and equipment inside his backpack while he's flying the craft. Furthermore, anywhere he would land it, or if he dropped something off of it, the location he dropped it would begin to have poltergeist phenomenon affecting it. People would start to hear voices and things would appear and move on their own and all these kinds of things, as if, you know, there was some kind of ripple, some kind of tear left behind from operating the craft, which was another reason he was like, well, this is getting weird. I'm done with it. I'm not going to do this anymore. And his research there kind of ends. There was a dude in the U.S. who kind of ran this free energy, like his whole thing was free energy, you know, Oregon energy and, you know, all these kind of, you know, what science says, fake pseudoscience energies. And he kind of got in touch with Gerbenikov's son and kind of got all these documents and this information. And he was kind of doing the research, but he passed away in 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And the case has kind of died off entirely. So ideally, one day, if I can ever get the visas and things in order, because traveling to Russia is not easy. But if I can ever get it in order, trying, I'd love to. I plan to go there and do a paranormal expedition and look into. He's got this segment of a museum that was dedicated to Gerbennikov and this CSE technology. He's still got family members alive. And I have a friend from Russia who's willing to help and, you know, some translating and stuff like that. So it's definitely a goal. I don't know when or how. She can't even get back into the country and she's from there. So
Wait, is it because of COVID or is it because of just it's hard to get into Russia?
Her issue is COVID. So yeah. Once they figure out she's just next door in Lithuania.
Yeah.
But once there's, you know, they solve that kind of immigration issue, then she has to sponsor me. And there's about a year's worth of paperwork and application after that. So it's a long process. But it's definitely one of the weirdest. I got to check it out because the crazy guy in Morocco told me and some other crazy source, it's quite this coincidence that, you know, all of these three, at least three people completely unconnected to each other have the same, well, hey, it's bees. This is it. And of course, the paranormal phenomenon is weird. That story is very, very weird. But when you look at it, you know, in a statistical kind of perspective, we know humans are real and we know they do some crazy things. Mm-hmm. And we know bees are real and there's some mysteries there. So statistically speaking, when you compare it to little green men or interdimensional entities, the bee theory holds up pretty well. Like it's a crazy story, but it's not the most improbable story we hear when it comes to these subjects. Gotta think about when every time I hear a UFO story, you know, I go through my initial analysis of it and then I run it through B theory and I'm like, well, how would this add up to what's happening in this situation? And it hasn't really failed yet. It hasn't been a point where I'm like, well, that case doesn't make any sense, because, you know, in his description of this craft, people being in and around it, it has this perverse effect on them. So they're not seeing the craft as a guy on a thing. They're seeing it as this disc. So they very well could be perceiving the people inside the disc as insects or little grays. You know, it could, there could be this whatever kind of reality's distortion that's caused by this craft could extend, you know, far on to the individual. And in my book, I write, and this again was before B theory, I wrote about how most paranormal phenomenon shares these intrinsic similarities to psychedelic phenomenon and psychedelic experiences. I think the abduction phenomenon is a perfect example of that. You have missing time, right? People go away. In the case of Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky, he thought he was gone for maybe like a couple hours and he was gone for 2 weeks. In South America, you have the Valdez case where he was a corporal abducted in front of his troops and he was gone for 15 minutes, but he came back with a full beard and his watch was spun forward 5 days. So you have these two iterations of it, both directions. On psychedelics, you have the same thing. I can tell you from personal experience, I thought I was doing something for like 5-10 minutes and it turns out to be 2-3 hours. Or the inverse is possible as well, where you're sure you were doing something for years and years and years. You hear this under salvia in particular, which is kind of a weird one to do. But people swap consciousness with objects and they throw that object for years. But a salvia hit in normal reality, whatever that is, only lasts 10-15 minutes at the most. So it's this dilation you have in both the abduction phenomenon and psychedelics. You also have the same kind of reactions to both those experiences. The abduction phenomenon is, you know, it's something that happens against people's will. they're taken in the middle of the night. But a lot of people come back with this feeling of oneness with the universe, mm-hmm. and that the aliens are here to help and raising vibrations, and they're good, and it's all peace and love.
Yeah.
And that's the feeling you get when you take mushrooms. anyone who has a good experience, who enjoys psychedelics, will tell you that's the experience. Now, there are other people who don't enjoy those experiences in psychedelics, and they describe it as the most terrifying thing they've ever seen. Again, you have that other flip view of people who have abductions, who say it's the most terrifying thing that's ever happened to them. It seems to be the same kind of duality and reaction. And then from there, you have the viewing of strange worlds, right? You under psychedelics, you see impossible landscapes and these kinds of things. In abduction phenomenon cases, you have people taken to Venus, where they see a lush green planet with beautiful naked women and all that kinds of stuff. Well, we know Venus isn't like that. They're obviously seeing something else. They're seeing some kind of different world. Again, very similar to someone who's under a very high dose of psychedelics. Yeah. So it's these, and the description of it being realer than real, again, mm-hmm. that's something you hear not only in psychedelics and the abduction phenomenon, but the near-death experience. People come back and say it's something more vivid than anything else you've ever seen. And we know that that experience is caused by DMT, but that's also an experience that lets people talk to their long lost loved ones and for spirits, or if you want to use that terminology. Yeah. So the paranormal phenomenon seems to share these intrinsic links with how our consciousness reacts to certain substances. And I don't want anyone to assume that I mean that it's all happening in people's heads.
Yeah.
Because people are clearly coming back from these experiences with physical changes. Some people have implants. Some people have scars. In the famous cases, Barney Hill from Betty and Barney, he had a ring of pimples around his junk where they suction cupped him. There's these weird things that something physical is happening. And Bigfoot cases, again, you have a lot of these parallels where you're, weird bendings of reality and missing time and these things. But he's also leaving a footprint, and he's mm-hmm. breaking into your camp. He's doing damage, leaving gifts. He seems to be this kind of ethereal entity. And poltergeist phenomenon has all of that, again, out of control. There was a friend in high school who told me of an experience with a Ouija board where he had some missing time. They were up there for what they thought was, an hour using this Ouija board, and they went downstairs and it was the next morning, 12 hours later. And so these things, again, people are in these altered states and they're having these same kind of experiences. But the difference in the psychedelic experience is I know it's happening. I'm doing mm-hmm. this to myself, and there's this knowing to it. These people, and most of these experiencers are, average people. They aren't psychedelics users. This is their first time having something they experience like this. And of course it sounds crazy. Of course it sounds paranormal. It is. It's something, undescribable. So to find, my research and my work is to find where it bleeds over. Where does those experiences become physical? And I think that's kind of the question for most of these people researching the paranormal, whether they know that's what they're looking for or not.
Yeah. Are you ever worried, especially with this B theory that you are going to attempt to work on, that it will catch the government's attention in a bad way?
I'm waiting for it. I've done a bunch of these shows. I've been plugging B theory. I'm waiting for them to knock on my door. Oh, it would validate me so much. It really would. It absolutely would. I don't think it, again, I'm just a crazy, I've already done enough in validating myself through my own research, right? No one's going to look at my book and be like, people who love the paranormal, absolutely, and people who love these theories, it's definitely cutting edge. If you like, you know, Mothman prophecies and those kinds of things. But the Harvard professor of anthropology might not feel the same way about it. He might be like, using psychedelics to investigate abhorrent. What a fool. You know, I don't think there's too much credibility to scare them into assassinating me or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope I get Man in Black. I wanna grab one.
if you get Man in Black, we want you to come back on to talk about it.
Oh, I will not see it. It would be and that's kind of the sticker of it, because I think they know that. I think they know if they got me, I'd never shut up about it. But I'm hoping it happens. I'm fascinated. The Men in Black thing's always been one, because when you listen to like John Keel stories and stuff, you know, there's the two types of Men in Black. You have the, you know, buzz cut military dude, shut up or we'll kick the shit out of you. And then you have the like these entities that almost seem like robots, where they don't know how to eat Jell-O and they've got wires hanging out of their clothing, and the one instance where it's the man and the woman, and they go in the house and he's asking the witnesses, these UFO witnesses, is this how you touch a woman? And he's grabbing her breast and stuff like that. They have these complete lack of understanding of social faux pas and things like that.
I had never heard that before. I've heard a lot of Men in Black stories, but I never heard that one.
Yeah, definitely check out, I think it's John Keel's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, or is that the other guy's? Oof. Forgive me, paranormal community. I've probably upset someone. Someone knows the answer.
Well, forgive you.
But They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. That's a great one, and it has these high strangeness cases. I think in the Mothman prophecies, they mention one where one of these men in black is able to melt a coin in his hand, and it liquefies this coin, and then he tells the witness, I can do this to your heart, so you better stop talking about UFO. So maybe no, see, then I'd be like, all right, what's the magic trick? I'd slap his hand to see if it was really a liquid, you know. I gotta touch one, and if it is a military guy, that's gonna be a really weird it's gonna be a weird day for both of us. It's going to be a weird day for me in the emergency room, and it's going to be a weird day of him explaining it to his officer. You were just supposed to scare him. He grabbed me. I'm sorry. It's going to be a weird encounter. So, you know, if they're listening, which I'm sure they are, come on, I'm ready. Let's do it. Let's dance.
Bring it on. I did not expect to like talk about all these things, but they're all of my favorite things to talk about. Which is amazing. So you brought up Bigfoot, and I don't know if you listen to the podcast. It's totally okay if you don't, but I am obsessed with Bigfoot, I guess, to put it lightly, like hardcore obsessed. And my theory is, because when you look into Bigfoot, like when you really look into it, there's a lot of orb sightings. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of I just heard him. I just saw him. Now I don't, but I saw an orb, and I really
poltergeist phenomenon. He seems to be a woodsy poltergeist in a lot of the most legitimate cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love Bigfoot. I wish he was easier to investigate.
Yeah.
I go out all the time to where I'm from. They have a local Bigfoot, the Myakka Monster. There's some really good photos of them out there. People say it's an orangutan, but it looks real scary.
What is it like, called?
It's the Myakka Monster. That's Myakka. And that's in South Florida outside of Sarasota.
My family lives there.
Yeah, everyone's does. I'm one of the only people from there. It's a big old retirement paradise. But yeah, if you go inland far enough, there'll be Bigfoots. There also, I wrote a great article about how there's been some tiger sightings out there too, like just loose Bengal tigers. I even saw something that may have been a tiger once when I was canoeing with some friends in the park. We thought it was this bench. We were like, oh, there's this bench all the way on this remote part of the park. I wonder how that got there. Let's go canoe out to it. And it stands up, and it's this big orange mass, and it runs off into the tree line. And me and one friend, we're pretty sure it's a tiger. My other friend, she doesn't. She disagrees to this day. She doesn't think it was a tiger. There were some other people out there who claimed to see tigers. So tigers, Bigfoots. There's also, in the realm of the paranormal, you have the phantom big cats, which are pretty popular in the UK, where there's a lot less tigers. Of course, tigers aren't native to Florida, but there's a lot of people with pet tigers.
There's a lot of dumb people, yeah.
Yeah, they're weird. There's some weirdos out there. So a lot of pet tigers out around Mayaca. A couple of them have probably gotten loose from time to time. But yeah, there's Bigfoot's one where, it's a hard thing to investigate without, really having a good location and some phenomenon appearing first. It's definitely one of those ones where I've been out to that park, a million times and maybe heard some weird things, but nothing enough that I would say it's a Bigfoot or something paranormal, because it's Florida. There's all kinds of creatures out there. So he's one of the tougher chestnuts of paranormal thing.
Yeah.
But I also think he's definitely one of the ones that deserves mention, because he is definitely, when it comes to high strangeness, Bigfoot stories are some of the weirdest ones. They get super bizarre. And again, it's very similar to poltergeist cases. If people are familiar with Jeff the Talking Mongoose in the UK, yeah. He was a poltergeist who was quite the little prankster and would tell people to go out in the middle of the night to remote places and dig for treasure and stuff like that. And Bigfoot does this in a lot of cases. I can't remember the name of her, but there's this little old lady from Alabama, and she had some YouTube videos, and she's been getting punked by Bigfoot for a while. I don't think she's making the stories up, because she's actually going out in the middle of the night to do these weird missions for him and find these things. And she's being pranked by an entity is what it really feels like. And that's something that pops up again and again and again in all of these paranormal phenomena, is the concept of the trickster. And it's definitely, I think, a thing that's important for paranormal researchers and investigators to keep in mind, because most of these entities, more often than not, seem to be pretty devious little buggers. What you can say about these entities is, it's something I always come back to. At the end of the day, I can't be sure it's a spirit of a dead person. I can't be sure it's an alien from a different planet. I can't be sure Bigfoot's a lost humanoid. What I am sure is that these things represent information, and that information can exist without humans. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that information's existing, but it's existing. And sometimes it's accurate. You have stories where, ghosts and things, entities predict people's deaths, and it comes true. They predict these things. Other times it's like Jeff the Talking Mongoose, and they're playing a joke on you. They're, messing with you. And it seems to be that happens a lot. So what we can say definitely is that this information exists somewhere non-physically. Mm-hmm. But it also, this information is capable of lying. So those are the two for sures we can take away from paranormal phenomenon at this point, until our reason, we capture one, till we get Bigfoot in a net, or we shoot an alien.
And shoot an alien.
What we can say for sure now is that these things represent this disincarnate information, and that they can lie. So we gotta be skeptical of these entities. And I think that's something missing in some people. I think Dr. Stephen Greer is a good example of that. I think he's buying into that message from these entities that they're here for love and light and peace.
Yeah.
You know, that's good and all, but they're still kidnapping people without their permission in the middle of the night. So without the consent there, that's a hard message for me to swallow, aliens. So again,
talking to you.
Yeah, coming at you guys, you men in black, all of you. I want get over here. Let's talk this out. But yeah, no, it's the phenomenon's definitely it's tricky, and I think that's an important thing to remember, no matter what aspect of it you're looking at.
Okay, so before we hang up, I want you to plug your social media, and then let people know where they can buy your book, because I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to get it after this.
Yeah, absolutely. You can follow me on social media at Chaz of the Dead. That's Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. That's all of them. You can find the book, Paranormal Expeditions, Hunt for the Friendship. It's available on Amazon, or you can DM me on any of the social medias, and I can sell you a copy directly, however you want to do it. And yeah, absolutely. My website is chazofthedead.com, and also check out Paranormality Magazine. They're doing a podcast awards and all that kind of cool stuff.